By the 1950s, the scientific community was beginning to grasp the severe, widespread impact humans could have on the global environment. However, this critical information remained beyond the reach of the public, shrouded in technical studies and complex data. A glaring illustration of this human impact was dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, better known as DDT. This chemical, the most potent pesticide the world had seen, laid bare the vulnerabilities of nature. Developed in 1939, DDT first proved its worth during World War II, eradicating malaria-inducing insects on South Pacific islands and serving as an effective delousing agent in Europe. Its developer even won a Nobel Prize for it. DDT was released for civilian use in 1945 and quickly gained popularity. Yet, amidst the widespread acclaim, a voice of caution emerged from nature writer Edwin Way Teal, who warned, "A spray as indiscriminate as DDT can upset the economy of nature as much as a revolution upset social economy. 90% of all insects are good, and if they are killed, things go out of kilter right away." Against the backdrop of growing pesticide use, Rachel Carson, a celebrated author and former marine biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, championed the resilience and interconnectedness of natural ecosystems. Her writings, which included bestsellers like Under the Sea Wind and The Sea Around Us, highlighted our symbiotic relationship within nature. Despite the popularity of her works, Carson hesitated to confront the pesticide issue directly due to anticipated backlash from chemical companies and complicit public officials. However, a letter from a friend about massive bird deaths in Massachusetts linked to DDT compelled her to act.
Now, to these people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene. Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity. The balance of nature is built of a series of interrelationships between living things and between living things and their environment. You can't just step in with some brute force and change one thing without changing as many others. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that we must never interfere, that we must not attempt to tilt that balance of nature in our favor. But unless we do bring these chemicals under better control, we are certainly headed for disaster.
She pitched an article to Reader's Digest about nearby DDT tests, but the proposal was rejected, underscoring the controversial nature of her findings. Undeterred, Carson began compiling her research into what would become Silent Spring, a detailed account of how DDT permeated the food chain, accumulated in animal tissues, and led to cancer and genetic damage. Navigating a breast cancer diagnosis herself, in her book, which she called her poison book, Carson advocated for a cautious approach to chemical use, stating,
"If we are living so intimately with chemicals, eating and drinking them, taking them into the very marrow of our bones, we had better know something about their power."
She painstakingly spent 4 years translating scientific data into simple information for a mass audience. Upon its publication on September 27, 1962, Silent Spring sparked widespread public outrage. So much so that during a presidential press conference, John F. Kennedy was questioned about and acknowledged the need for a government investigation into synthetic pesticides, propelled in part by Carson's influential work.
There appears to be growing concern among scientists as to the possibility of dangerous long-range side effects from the widespread use of DDT and other pesticides. Have you considered asking the Public Health Service to take a closer look at this?
Yes, I know that they already are. I think particularly, of course, since Ms. Carson's book, but they are examining the matter.
I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Going Green.
We have to choose to say no, to give up some luxuries. And these kinds of decisions will be the real measure of our commitment to the environment.
I don't think there's any other issue viewed in its broadest sense, which is as critical to mankind, as the issue of the quality of the environment in which we live.
We previously went on a sweeping journey through the transformation of the American landscape and the hard-learned lessons of ecological mismanagement. I highlighted, in the wake of destruction, there's always room for innovation and recovery. Figures like George Washington Carver, Buckminster Fuller, and pioneers in climate science such as Guy Callender and Charles David Keeling remind us that through ingenuity and careful study, we can find ways to harmonize our technological advancements with the natural world. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. Now, in May 1963, Kennedy's Science Advisory Committee issued a report confirming many of Rachel Carson's warnings, advocating for more restrained pesticide use and further research into their health impacts. Marking a pivotal moment in environmental science, Silent Spring not only transformed public awareness, but also helped initiate a series of regulatory reforms that would change our relationship with the environment. And I'll get into that after the break. Episode 3, The Longer We Wait, The Larger the Problem. Human interaction with the environment has evolved from the early awareness of hunter-gatherers into the sophisticated global environmental movement of today. Evidence from 50,000 BCE suggests early humans may have contributed to resource depletion and extinctions of species, likely responding by migrating to new areas. Historical records from over 5,000 years ago show an ecological consciousness, with ancient texts and myths emphasizing the importance of living in harmony with nature and expressing concern over the consequences of environmental destruction. Over centuries, this awareness deepened as civilizations recognized the impacts of their actions. The Indus civilization, a Bronze Age civilization in the northwestern regions of South Asia, practiced advanced waste management. Ancient Greeks noted deforestation effects. And by 1306, concerns about coal smoke led to England's King Edward I's limit on coal burning. These actions reflected a growing understanding of human health and environmental connections, prompting early forms of ecological advocacy. Significantly, the 18th century marked the beginning of formal environmental rights. Figures like Benjamin Franklin in America and Jeremy Bentham in Britain advocated for public health and animal rights, respectively. By the 19th century, thinkers like Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau inspired a deeper appreciation and respect for nature, leading to movements aimed at conserving natural spaces and wildlife. During the 1950s, as the world faced significant environmental issues, environmental groups warned about the consequences of plastics, chemicals, synthetics, pesticides, and fossil fuels, namely the 1952 air pollution incident in London that killed 12,000 people. It wasn't until then that the issue was taken more seriously. These efforts led to the founding of influential organizations like the Sierra Club and later Greenpeace, signaling a shift from individual advocacy to organized global environmental activism. In the early 1960s, a series of significant environmental events and publications marked the growing public and governmental awareness of environmental issues. In 1960, President Eisenhower initiated a study on air pollution from cars, while renowned figures like Jacques Cousteau opposed French plans for atomic dumping in the Mediterranean, reflecting a rising global environmental consciousness. The same year saw opposition to nuclear projects in Alaska, led by figures such as Celia Hunter. In 1961, environmental advocacy gained momentum with the founding of the World Wildlife Fund and other initiatives that encouraged international conservation funded by hunting permits. This period also witnessed heightened risk, highlighted by a nuclear meltdown in Idaho and a near-nuclear disaster in North Carolina. Rachel Carson brought the environmental movement into focus with the 1962 publication of Silent Spring. The movement transformed as environmental concerns became alarming to the average citizen, stimulating the fear that ecological damage at the current rate could endanger the survival of humans and the planet. In the post-World War II era, hundreds of thousands of young Americans turned away from the comfortable middle-class life their parents had established, embracing a rebellious spirit. The visible signs of the 1960s hippie counterculture included long hair, bell-bottom jeans, flower crowns, and the use of mind-altering drugs. However, its deeper impact came from the radical social and political movements it spurred, notably civil rights, opposition to the Vietnam War, and the nascent environmental movement. Widespread protests provided a vehicle for environmental discourse to further surge in the national consciousness, even permeating entertainment. Tom Lehrer, an American musician, singer-songwriter, satirist, and mathematician, recorded and performed a song titled Pollution on a satirical U.S. TV show called That Was the Week That Was.
If you visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, we got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See the halibuts and the sturgeons being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste.
In 1965, a U.S. President's Advisory Committee panel warned that the greenhouse effect is a matter of, quote, real concern. And on February 8th, in a special message to Congress on conservation and restoration of natural beauty, U.S. President Lyndon Johnson warns of buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
This generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through radioactive materials and a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. Pollution destroys beauty and menaces health. It cuts down on efficiency, reduces property values, and raises taxes. The longer we wait to act, the greater the dangers and the larger the problem.
In 1965, the U.S. saw significant environmental action as Congress enacted the Water Quality Act, Noise Control Act, and Solid Waste Disposal Act, establishing essential environmental standards. The Sierra Club set a legal precedent by successfully suing to protect New York's Storm King Mountain, marking a milestone for environmental advocacy by securing legal standing based on non-economic interests. In the workplace, the U.S. Public Health Service released a report advocating for improved worker safety and health in the face of new technological challenges. This report paved the way for the establishment of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. That same year, tragedy reinforced the need for environmental action. A phenomenon known as weather inversion occurred in New York City, leading to a severe air pollution event where a noxious combination of sulfur dioxide and carbon monoxide blanketed the city. Normally, air temperature gradually decreases as altitude increases, but in an inversion, this relationship is reversed. In the right conditions, a warmer air mass can move over a cooler one, preventing any movement of the cooler air mass. In a polluted area, the denser, cooler air traps the pollution close to the ground. New York City already had a problem with pollution. That year, deaths from pulmonary emphysema and chronic bronchitis skyrocketed. Reports estimate that smog killed anywhere from 169 to 400 people throughout that year. The inversion event began on November 20th. By the 23rd, the buildup of sulfur dioxide and the visible smoke shade from the particulates and chemicals of factories, chimneys, and vehicles began to interfere with the atmosphere. The pollution was 2 to 3 times higher than usual. The population of the area affected by the smog has been estimated at 16 million people. The city would not receive relief for 3 days until a cold front finally arrived on November 26, clearing out the warm air. It's not clear there were any deaths because of and during the event specifically, but a study found that 10% of the city's population had developed some negative health effects from the smog, including symptoms like stinging eyes, coughing, wheezing, the coughing up of phlegm, or difficulty breathing. This and similar events kept the environmental conversation top of mind and further highlighted the need for regulatory oversight in the U.S. In Britain, the collapse of the Seagem offshore oil platform did the same, as the catastrophe resulted in deaths of 9 people, underscoring the risk of industrial advancements. Together, these events continue to raise awareness and spurred environmental and public health policies. Despite this growing consciousness, environmental activists hadn't yet coalesced into a true movement reminiscent of the civil rights and anti-war activists. The slow growth had long frustrated Gaylord Nelson, a Democratic senator who was one of Congress's most passionate environmentalists.
Thanks to Senator Nelson, the beautiful St. Croix River in northwestern Wisconsin, with towering bluffs and clear, cool water, is going to be saved from the pollution and commercialization which have spoiled most of America's great rivers.
Born in 1916 to a nurse and rural doctor, Nelson's early life in Clear Lake, Wisconsin, instilled in him a deep connection to community and nature. His academic journey led him from a political science degree at San Jose State University to a law degree from the University of Wisconsin, setting the stage for his distinguished political career. After serving as a first lieutenant in World War II, Nelson entered politics, first as a state senator and then as the governor of Wisconsin. His tenure was marked by progressive policies and an early commitment to environmental and consumer protection. In 1962, he advanced to the U.S. Senate, where he remained a significant figure until 1981, supporting civil rights and vigorously opposing the Vietnam War. Nelson's environmental legacy, however, was cemented with the creation of Earth Day in 1970. In August 1969, Nelson traveled to California, where he spoke at a water conference and visited the scene of an oil spill in Santa Barbara. On that trip, he was struck by an article he read in Ramparts magazine about the anti-war teach-ins held on college campuses in the mid-1960s. Teach-ins were a form of protest, where seminars were held on a specific political or social issue. The first teach-in was conducted at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, where 200 faculty members canceled regular classes and held special anti-war seminars. Rallies and speeches dominated for 12 hours. Nelson envisioned a similar event, a National Day of Environmental Education and Advocacy. Recognizing the power of grassroots mobilization, Nelson set April 22, 1970 as the date for a nationwide environmental teach-in, which he announced with the help of Republican Congressman Pete McCloskey of California, who served as his co-chair on the committee behind the event. Despite his otherwise conservative views, McCloskey was a committed environmentalist who also opposed the Vietnam War. Leading up to the event, a groundbreaking 1969 book, Design with Nature, had arrived, echoing the spirit of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and catalyzing what would become known as the Environmental Decade. The author, Ian McHarg, was a Scottish landscape architect and writer on regional planning using natural systems. He has profoundly influenced landscape architecture over the past half century and put forth concepts that spurred significant environmental legislation in the United States, including the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, and the enactment of the National Environmental Policy Act, among others. McHarg introduced the layer cake method of suitability analysis in landscape architecture, a technique that predated modern geographic information systems, or GIS, and integrated science, art, and planning. His methodology emphasized that landscape architecture was uniquely poised to address ecological problems by revealing the, quote, right answers through data. McHarg fully embraced the idea of Earth Day. As chair of the University of Pennsylvania's Department of Landscape Architecture and Regional Planning, he took a key role in planning for Philadelphia's Earth Day event. Meanwhile, back in Milwaukee, the day before Earth Day, Senator Nelson spoke on the upcoming event.
It's tremendously encouraging to see all across this country the remarkable interest on the campuses and off the campuses on an issue which is not only just an issue of survival, but an issue of how we survive. I don't think there's any other issue viewed in its broadest sense, which is as critical to mankind, as the issue of the quality of the environment in which we live. You hear the word ecology. That's a big science, not a narrow one. It's a big concept. And it is concerned with all the ramifications of all the relationships of all living creatures to each other and their environment. It is concerned with the total ecosystem, not just how we dispose of tin cans, bottles, and our garbage. It is concerned with the habitat of marine creatures, animals, birds, and man. And our goal is not just an environment of clean air and water and scenic beauty while forgetting about the worst environments in America, in the ghettos, in Appalachias, and elsewhere. Our goal is an environment of decency, quality, and mutual respect for all human beings and all other living creatures. An environment without ugliness, without ghettos, without poverty, without discrimination, without hunger, and without war. Our goal is a decent environment in its broadest and deepest sense. And winning the environmental war is a whole lot tougher battle, challenge, by far, than any other challenge ever to confront mankind. We could terminate our involvement in Laos in 30 days, and it's my belief we should, and we could terminate our involvement in the killings in Vietnam in 120 days, and I think we should. But wish for it, work for it, fight for it, commit unlimited resources to it. Nevertheless, the battle to restore a proper relationship between man and his environment, between man and other living creatures, will require a long, sustained political, moral, ethical, and financial commitment far beyond any commitment ever made by any society in the history of man. Are we able? Yes. Are we willing? That's the unanswered question.
The first Earth Day was a phenomenal success, galvanizing over 20 million Americans. Events range from protests and educational forums to symbolic acts like the Dead Orange Parade in Miami, a spoof of the Orange Bowl Parade, where some Miami activists created 24 floats depicting scenes like a globe in a coffin, a toilet used as a stand-in for Biscayne Bay, and a surfboard that complained about feces in the water. in Philadelphia, McHarg famously challenged the public with a stark message about industrial threats to future survival, reflecting his vision of landscape architecture that served ecological integrity over capitalist interests. He envisioned the profession as a guardian of public and natural interests against unchecked development. As department chair, McHarg was also tasked to identify and invite speakers for the Philadelphia event. Among those were Ralph Nader, Nobel Prize-winning biochemist George Wald, poet Allen Ginsberg, the cast of the era's iconic Broadway musical Hair, and U.S. Senator Edmund Muskie.
The kind of do-it-yourself devastation.
We've reached a point where our technology produces more kinds of things than we really want, more kinds of things than we really need, more kinds of things than we can live with. We have to choose to say no, to give up some luxuries. And these kinds of decisions will be the real measure of our commitment to the environment.
This unprecedented public participation across the nation led to significant environmental legislation. The EPA was established by President Richard Nixon in 1970, and the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and Endangered Species Act were passed throughout the 1970s. All legislation that you'll find very much displeased pro-business conservatives. Senator Nelson's vision for Earth Day transcended its countercultural roots to become a mainstream movement, embedding environmentalism in the national conscience and prompting academic initiatives, with colleges across the U.S. establishing environmental studies programs to nurture the next generation of environmentalists. This activity also set the stage for the modern era of sustainable architecture, as architects began to take a much more holistic approach to building design. Architects were inspired to reduce building greenhouse gas emissions, protect natural resources, and create healthier living environments for people. Concepts such as airtight envelopes, natural ventilation, and passive solar heating became mainstream, leading to advanced sustainable features such as green roofs, photovoltaics, geothermal heating systems, and earthen construction as the movement evolved. The counterculture rebellion against high-rise congestion and suburban sprawl motivated some of the earliest and most dedicated eco-activists to move to rural communes where they lived in tent-like structures and geodesic domes. And we'll further explore this architectural evolution next time on Going Green.
There is a seeking to return to the larger tradition of architecture, not to revive it, because it's very hard. No one can ever revive anything. No one knows exactly what was in the minds of any individual before or in any epoch before, but to see that work of the past.
Thanks for listening. Going Green is a Spaces podcast story brought to you by Lines. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question, want to submit a correction, or just share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. That's lynes.studio/podcasts. And listen in to my wrap-up episode to hear my response. If you're looking for similar content, Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com, that's gablemedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content that I found during my research, you can visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.